So today we are interviewing Peter Werby. We are at the Purdy Kresge Library on Wayne State's campus. It is December 15th, 2016. And Peter Werby is the longtime editor of the Fifth Estate magazine and also the host of the radio shows, The Peter Werby Show and Night Call. So let's see.
And I would, the only correction I would make is that I am a member. We've, for the longest time, we've had what we either we call an editorial collective or an editorial group. And so for the last 40 years, I've just been just another member of the paper.
Just one of the guys.
Yes, one of the guys.
Okay.
Two gals.
All right. So you've been very political through your entire adult life. What was your upbringing, and did that help spurn you into being a political person?
Well, it did. One of the typical '60s things, you have these religious conservative parents. But there's another phenomenon too, and that's what's called a red diaper baby. And these were people that were born into leftist homes, very frequently into parents that were members of the Communist Party, whereas my parents were just very, very liberal. And so back, it's 2015, I'm 75 years old, so, you know, my coming to consciousness came about in an era where there was still, you know, strict segregation and, you know, more racism than today, if you can imagine that. And so my parents were always, you know, very anti-racist, anti-war. They backed a third-party candidate for president in 1948, Henry Wallace, that was ran on the Progressive Party. No relationship to the guy from Alabama. So I have a very liberal left background, and my parents were always very supportive. My dad at one time even took photographs for the Fifth Estate newspaper at big marches.
Awesome. And how did you end up in this counterculture kind of community here in Detroit?
Well, it's like a lot of stuff. It just sort of happened. It was, if you will, the zeitgeist. It was the spirit of the times. It happened everywhere. And although it seems, when you look back on an era, like I asked my mother one time, was she a flapper during the 1920s? And she said, what? You know, because some people, certain things or people be, or lifestyles or subcultures become sort of iconic, but they don't represent everybody. So what we thought, the whole area that we're in now, what we used to call the Warren Forest area, or what's that other phrase now forgotten? Cass Corridor, oh yeah. Now the Midtown, rebranded. But it was there. And this area, of course, going back at least into the 1930s, were always where political leftists, cultural workers, you know, painters and writers and poets assembled. And and during the late 1950s, it was where beatniks, that phenomenon, the Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg types, hung out. And then as the 60s took off with the white support of the civil rights movement, the growing anti-war movement against the Vietnam War, it was all right here. And we usually attribute the foundation of the Fifth Estate newspaper to one person, which he did, Harvey Ovshinsky, O-V-S-H-I-N-S-K-Y. And he, you know, he had the idea to do this. I didn't have the idea. Nobody else in Detroit did. So it's individual genius. But it only could have happened in a milieu that was already in motion and set in motion by what was happening in the rest of the country and the rest of the world.
And how did you get involved with the Fifth Estate?
Well, actually, I was an activist in what was called the Detroit Committee to End the War in Vietnam. And it was located, we had an office on the corner of Warren and the Lodge Service Drive, now a parking lot. And where's historic, where's Wayne, what is that, Wayne Preservation when we need him? But, and all of a sudden this, I was always the oldest. So like in 1965, I was 25. And every, you know, people were like in their late teens and early 20s. And this teenager came in, I think he was like 17 or 18, and said, hey, I've got this newspaper. Does anybody want to help me on it? Because if it doesn't, it's going to go out of existence. And everybody thought, nah, we got our hands filled you know, fighting this war that was growing all the time. And I was the person that said, you know, I think we could put a lot of anti-war information about meetings and our views that were contrary to what was in all of the mass media at the time. I mean, the Detroit News, the Detroit Free Press, the three channels that we had access to at the time were all staunchly pro-war. It was necessary, pardon me, to, you know, stop the march of communism in Southeast Asia. And so this, to me, was extraordinarily important work.
This is more a tangent than anything else, but since you were involved in this anti-war organization, how did you personally avoid the draft?
Well, that's a tangent that might take some time. I actually went, you know what? Don't put this in there, but I'm trying to strike a couple of things out of my speaking. Actually, getting rid of actually and kind of and sort of.
Got it.
Take those all out of all of this because it's terrible. I was eligible for the draft like all these warmongers like Cheney and Bush and the rest of them. Initially, we had student deferments, but then as they needed more for the meat grinder that they were sending people in. At one time, they had half a million soldiers in Vietnam. They got rid of all that. And I was 25, so this was 1965. And so I went down to what was called the pre-induction center at Fort Wayne at the time. And he had to take all these tests. I don't know if you ever, there was a classic rock song, Alice's Restaurant. He said, you want to know if I'm moral enough to kill women and children and burn villages? So I went down there and caused an enormous commotion, which is a story in itself. Almost got in fights with MPs. I mean, this was my intent, because I thought they would mark me 4F, unavailable for a draft.
Does not do well with authority.
Yeah. So I actually put that on a form. They said, any psychological problems? And I said, I'm absolutely unable to follow orders or respond to authority in any manner. But it didn't work, so I filed a conscientious objector for conscious objector status, which meant you had to have like a, I'm a Quaker. And so I said, I just made up this crazy religion, the universal this of that and all that, and filed it. And the appeals would have taken me beyond my 26th birthday in June of 1966. So I was home free. So I scammed out because I was smart enough and white enough and middle class, which left, you know, the working class whites and minorities to fight the war and,
of course,
get killed. Yeah.
That's good. Well, not good, but...
Yeah, I hear you.
Good to have. Let's see. What's next? You guys are around the Wayne State community. How do you think the Wayne State community contributed to the Fifth Estate and to kind of that anti-establishment culture?
Well, a lot of the instructors were themselves liberals or progressives or even leftists. And there was a man picked, I was just going to write him. I'm glad to see he's still alive. He's probably in his mid-80s, Norman Pollack, P-O-L-L-A-C-K. And he wrote a lot about these populist movements of the 1890s in the South. Integrated movements, you know, that were taking on the big landowners and the banks and what have you. And it was like university and university districts always are. They'll, you know, even though the general culture is wearing crew cuts, you can have, you know, a man can have hair to his shoulders, or a woman can not wear a bra, or you know, all those things you think of when you think of the 60s without the kind of I use that word without, actually it fits there, doesn't it? Without the sort of criticism you get. When I went to Ferris State in 1959, and my hair was shorter than it is now, and for the record, it's not that long, right?
No.
Yeah, I remember this frat rat, as we used to call him, yelled out the window, "Get your hair cut! You're disgracing our school." But the urban schools, certainly around Columbia, you know, Allen Ginsberg and all those people that there, and University of Chicago, NYU, all of those were the milieu in which nonconformists. That was a word. I remember even getting interviewed in the 60s, and someone said, "Why are you a nonconformist?" because conformity sucks, it's boring. and what they want you to conform to is pretty awful and often pretty evil.
Right.
Yeah.
So I, from other research that I've done, the South End was radicalized at the time, and that was another newspaper that was kind of being published right in this area. Mm-hmm. Did you guys have a relationship? Was there any sort of, you know,
communication? Yeah, absolutely. It was called the Daily Collegian, and the last editor was a guy that would always have his photograph in the paper with a suit and tie on. You know, these were people who used everything at the university simply as a catapult to, you know, careers in, you know, like, you know, mainstream society. So he wanted, I can't remember his name, but he wanted to be, you know, and that's understandable. But what we saw these papers all about were changing the country, part of this mass movement that was questioning every part of American society. So someone who wrote for the Fifth Estate, Art Johnston, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N, became the editor, changed it to the South End, and he didn't see it going too deep. At the North End was the GM building. At the South End was Wayne State University. I wonder how many people know that, even on the work on that paper today. Suddenly it became filled with information about demonstrations and, you know, music from the Grandy Ballroom and poetry readings, and just like the Fifth Estate was. And so, and we had features on art. And oh, and he, contrary to the last Daily Collegian editor, a photograph we ran of Art in the Fifth Estate, he was on his chopper wearing his leathers. So the times they are a-changing, as somebody once sang.
And then the other, the major, of course, historical community that was happening in the 60s was they went through a lot of names, Detroit Artist Workshop, the White Panthers, the, there was one other one, Rainbow People Party?
The what? Oh, Rainbow People's Party, yeah.
Yeah. What kind of relationship did the Fifth Estate have? I know John Sinclair worked on the Fifth Estate for
right.
a while.
John Sinclair was actually, yeah. There you go again, that A word. John Sinclair contributed to the second issue of the Fifth Estate even before I was involved in it. And he brought this information about music and art and poetry and writing that was buried so deep because it never had any expression anywhere. The Artist Workshop admirably printed up their own little booklets on a process called mimeograph, and they would put together these books of mimeographed poetry or, you know, other kinds of writing, and they brought in different musicians, mostly jazz. In fact, all jazz at that time. He was, as we were, not very appreciative of rock and roll. I mean, I thought the Beatles were so bad and so dumb and so stupid. I didn't and still don't have very much affection for Motown at all. It's just pop music. You know, I don't know where your tastes lie now, but I can't even think of a, what's that one, like Adele, or I don't even know, I wouldn't even know.
That's probably the higher class of,
is it? Okay.
Of pop right now.
What's that guy that's always getting in trouble?
Justin Bieber.
Bieber.
Is who you're looking for.
Yeah, Bieber. Yeah, that was like Bieber stuff to us, where we were listening to, you know, we were too hip for the room, put that in quotes. And so we were listening to John Coltrane and Miles Davis and a lot of experimental music, what's called free jazz, which is without any structure to it, and people just, it sounds just like you're tuning up. Right. You ever heard that kind of music?
Yes.
Okay, good. Like they play now at, what is it, Trinosophies or Trinosope on Gratiot Avenue.
Not that
yeah.
cool.
Yeah. 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 So it was John brought this all to the Fifth Estate and brought it all to Detroit. So there was this absolute intermingling of all of the Artist Workshop, of the Rainbow People's Party. That was sort of, yeah, kind of a footnote of John. But the White Panther, which, and then, you know, involving the MC5 with that, that had this, that brought essentially a revolutionary message to kids that came out to listen to rock and roll. I mean, they expected that. I mean, it wasn't that they were say, okay, we're going to play you some tunes, but then secretly sneak in some commie message. It was bundled, you know, like that.
Yeah, I was listening to MC5 on the way here, the American Ruse type stuff.
Well, most of their stuff is not, that's like on the second or even third album, I can't remember. Their big album was recorded live at the Grandy Ballroom, and that, I don't think, has any political songs. Maybe the Motor City's Burning, which is a great blues tune, was written by Detroit's John Lee Hooker, altered a little for their purposes. But it was, the music was revolutionary in the sense that it broke through the Perry Como's and the well-loved and respected Frank Sinatra and the rest of those white guys that kind of sounded almost like they were talking with a little bit of melodic tone to their voice. Whereas these new bands appropriated black music and in many ways also appropriated the style of singing, that kind of gravelly voice. You think of Bob Seger or people like that. And so it was all part and parcel. So at the Grandy Ballroom, you would have John Lee Hooker, you'd have B.B. King, or a lot of white blues groups, Brownsville Station, and people like that. And most of the music at that time, at least, was to some extent blues influence. I mean, I think that was probably the what motivated the most rock and roll. I don't know, things like American Ruse, I'm not sure that had blues stuff in it or not. But yeah, it was all part of we called it the movement with a capital T and a capital M. And this was, and people would say the movement is this. So it could be, a concert at the Fillmore in San Francisco or the Grandy in Detroit. It could be a march on Washington in 1967 or 1968. But we thought we were simultaneously bringing about the Age of Aquarius and World Revolution. And some people, the hard-nosed politicos, only were interested in, World Revolution, and they admired armed struggle against the, support of the National Liberation Front in Vietnam and Cuba and Angola and places like that. And the Age of Aquarius people, like, wow, man, we're all just going to, be high and naked and love one another right now, is one of the lines of the song goes, which I thought a nice melding of it worked perfectly. Right. And in a way, that's what the Fifth Estate was, too.
So location-wise, where was the Fifth Estate located in Detroit?
In Detroit, a number of places. It was at 1107 West Warren, which, is on the corner, the southwest corner of the Lodge and Warren. And right next to it, 1101, this is where the Detroit Committee to End the War in Vietnam was. And the whole building was interconnected with corridors. So you could, and around the corner on the Lodge Freeway, that's where the artist workshop was. So you could literally go from one to another. And although some of the people overlap, maybe somebody like me the most, most everybody participated in all of it. So the artist workshop people would come to a demonstration against the war. The people from the Detroit Committee to End the War in Vietnam would write articles for the Fifth Estate. And it looked like the world was ours, because we should joke that we hadn't gone north of 8 Mile Road in 10 years, and barely north of McNichols. And so you would walk around that area, and you'd see another brother or sister, as we'd call everybody, and you would walk by a stranger and raise your fists and go, power to the people, and the person would go, power to the people. So, I mean, it was similar to, in a way, what happened in Europe in the 1930s, where you would have these radical districts that were mostly trade union districts, and so the area, it wouldn't exactly be dual power, do you know what I mean? So in other words, you'd have the power of the state, but you'd also have these institutions that the rebels administered that also had an effect of daily life. Like if something happened, somebody broke into somebody's house, they wouldn't call the police. They would come say, hey, blah, 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 took my box. which was a little stereo. And we would convene some people would go see him, hey man, come on. Well, no man, he owed me $9, so you would work it out rather than the guy calling the police and having to go through that. I think I drifted from your question.
Well, that was probably part of the anti-establishment thing too, right?
Don't yeah,
trust the
police. Right.
Especially Detroit police were likely very corrupted around that time.
They were corrupt. They were brutal. They were like the Chicago police are today. They killed a lot of people. They took a lot of bribes. They were pretty awful. Yeah.
So, let's see. I know from hearing from the workshop that the hippies were not treated very well during the riots because they were part of that Detroit community. What was your personal experience of, though you don't seem like the kind of person that might call it the riots?
You know, yeah, I've been dealing with the Detroit Historical Museum people. Tracy Irwin, you know any of those folks over there? And they had to go through a whole thing. Was it a riot? Was it a rebellion? Was it an insurrection? Was it, they've decided to call it a civil disturbance. I said, Tracy, that's like calling torture enhanced interrogation. You know, I don't have any problem calling it a riot, but Frank Joyce, a good friend of mine and probably one of the smartest guys I know, he has a whole reason why it was a rebellion. I think rebellions usually are programmatic. People revolt and they say, we want, or we are specifically revolting against this, and hence, you know, we're breaking all your windows or turning over cop cars. This was just, I mean, in a sense, every riot is a rebellion. A rock and roll riot is a rebellion. You're rebelling against, it's a transgression. You know, you have the society puts limits on what you can do. I mean, a hockey riot is a revolt, you know, or, we covered it. Harvey Ovshinsky and I went out, and the mayor at the time, Jerome Kavanaugh, said he was appalled. There was a carnival-like atmosphere there. And indeed it was. Everybody was, it was like a loot fest. It was just, one of the things they had during the 60s were called free stores, where people just brought stuff and you could either bring stuff or take stuff, whatever you wanted. And it was part of like living outside of capital. You could sell Fifth Estates for, ready, 15 cents a piece. And you could, if you sold, I don't know, 100 of them in a week, you probably could get along okay, or some other little hustles. And so it was like a big free store. And people were even selected. They didn't go into the mom and pop stores, but trash. They did, some, everything kind of went on 12th Street. But a lot of places, people specifically said, you know, stay away from the little stores. And so Harvey and I were just, we were standing in front of looted stores, and we loved it. Integrated looting. I have this image. There was a Kroger's on Trumbull, just south of Warren, and there was this white kid. There was, the whole front window was broken out. People were pouring in and out and taking groceries, and there was this white kid that had all these bags. And as people went in, he would snap them open and say, "Here's your bag." You know? he wasn't even. It was this what's called. He used the word Kavanaugh used the word festival. There's something called the Festival of the Oppressed, that people, when certain pressure is either gets too great or it's relieved, they explode, and a lot of times they don't do things that are very pleasant for everybody. Certainly, there was people tend to celebrate that rebellion, but there sure were a lot of negatives involved in it as well. And if you ever get into it, this Frank Joyce has an amazing, you know, was that whites left the city after that? Mm-hmm. And he says the other way around. The riot was caused by whites leaving the city. I mean, that by 67, services had collapsed, again, the cops had gotten worse, all of that. But so we were all up and down there. There's a whole, our headline of the July 1967 Fifth Estate says, get the big stuff, in quotes. You know, it was over, so we weren't, telling people to go out and get the big stuff. And we had a lot of friends, there were a lot of projects. In fact, Frank Joyce had a project called the Northern Student Movement, and they did a lot of organizing of young African-American workers on the east side. And so we were all over on the east side during that. And the only people you had to worry about were the police. I mean, you didn't have to, I don't know how other people in the suburbs at the time looked at this, but the idea of quote, rioting colored people, close quote, probably, you know, as it always has in American history, scared the crap out of white people. Whereas, and if I would tell them I was walking down Kercheval, or walking down Trumbull or something like that, they would have thought I had taken my life in my hands, where the only fear I had were the police or the National Guard.
And you even had relative safety from them because you were white. And
probably.
Probably weren't getting shot by snipers in the streets.
Yeah. But one of the things I want to say, there were no snipers.
There were no snipers.
No snipers. But that maybe is for another, unless you want, no conversation. Those were all crazed National Guardsmen from Kalkaska shooting up in the air and having it. The front page of the Fifth Estate from that issue I was talking about talks about armed gangs of Negroes, popular, you know, a word at the time, shooting at cops, pinning down whole police precincts and all that. And subsequent investigations said this was, you know, they'd be shooting like crazy. The National Guard ran out of ammunition. They brought in finally the 101st and 82nd Airborne. You know, these guys were supposed to go off to Nam, and they wound up coming to Detroit instead. It like ended immediately as soon as they came in. But, you're going a long time about that. But they really, you know, when someone says, and I'm not, you know, I'm not being critical of you, when someone says there were snipers, I'd say, you know, give me your sources. Because there's a lot of things that we say that popular. There were snipers in Detroit, Vietnam veterans got spit on, none were. If you want to, you know, you go, And whenever we talk about that, you know, I'm like on my radio show, I said, what makes you think Vietnam veterans were spit on? And then there's this blank, because it's this, you know, social trope that people all believe because somehow it's gotten into their mind or it's become just sort of a metaphor for disrespecting veterans, which didn't happen either. I mean, veterans were at the lead of, if you went to a big, I don't know, you ever go into any demonstrations ever?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's okay. And, you know, you might have 100 people out there. I mean, imagine in a million people, I mean, this is any number of times this happened. Right at the front would be active duty GIs, men, you know, once in a while women, but almost always men, and which could be subject to court-martial for being there. Say this is like 1968 or something like that. So there could be maybe 200 active duty GIs. Then there could be maybe 2,000 veterans of Vietnam. Then there could be 5,000 veterans of other wars, and then there would be other people. So the veterans were never, you know, disrespected in the way that's come across, and unfortunately down through American history. In fact, there's something in here. There's an article about Jane Fonda being called Hanoi Jane by this guy that wrote this book called Spitting Image, The Spitting Image, about that. And he talks about at the time, there's no mention whatsoever, ever, about a returning GI being spit on. In fact, in many ways, and I don't want to take up all the time, it's almost logistically impossible for that to have happened. You know, lonely guy walking through San Francisco airport, some hippie comes up to him and spits in his face, right? Right? Isn't that kind of the trope? Yeah. Yeah. But.
Yeah, no.
Where's the music? But it's okay. Go ahead.
I'll get to that in just a sec. I just want to make sure I don't lose the Fifth Estate here. The Fifth Estate was obviously very critical of authority and very outspoken. Were there ever any major threats or, you know, authority coming back on you?
Well, yeah, there was something, and it wouldn't surprise me if they still have it, something they called the Red Squad. Reds were communists, and these had begun like in the late teens of the last century that kept under J. Edgar Hoover, and they had what they call Red Scare, and they had one after World War I, and they had, of course, during the 1950s, Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they had all sorts of spies and infiltrators and what have you. Sometime in the mid-70s, there was this lawsuit filed against the Michigan State Police and against the Detroit Police to give up their records that they'd kept on everybody for the last like 55 years or something, and they actually had to turn them over. And so we, you know, a lot of us that applied got them back, these huge files, which they just were trailing us everywhere. And a lot of it was sort of purposeless. I mean, to say that I was at a meeting at Central Methodist Church, you know, what's that all about? But they actually had it, they had it into, I can't remember this, but they had like something, I'm not sure this is exact, but like white radicals and white extremists. And the radicals, they actually tried to interfere with their operations. They would break, and this happened all over the country. They would go to our printer and say, "Don't print the Fifth Estate," which happened. They would break in and try to steal our mailing list, because what they were in was about lists. And as you indicated earlier, being white and middle class, I'll tell you one of the things when you said. I said I was worried about, maybe I even said frightened. I would, if I said frightened, I would, of the Detroit police, I would back that up and say I was a little worried, because there was certainly a white skin privilege that nothing could happen to me, even though, you know, we knew what happened to black people. And the same thing here, we sort of laughed at it, that they were collecting all our names, and look, here, you know, mine, how big is that? Do you have to say that? 3 inches, 2 inches?
3 inches, yeah.
Yeah. Of files, and I would say of any real shockers or weird stuff, there could have been 8 pages in mine. So, and let me see, as I would say, knowing what a ream of paper, it's probably 650 pages of it. 10 pages of it, you would think, whoa. But then you realize there was an infiltrator, an informant that they had placed into our groups to keep track of what we were doing. And again, I used to kind of laugh at it. And if you go over to the Museum of Contemporary Art in Detroit, you'll see a page from the FBI which describes me and, you know, working on the Fifth Estate and belonging to the Detroit Committee to end the war in Vietnam. And there's another one that I have, because I have my FBI file as well, that says previous addresses. And they have my addresses going back till I was 8 years old. And again, you kind of laugh, and you're smiling now, and I always laughed at it. I mean, it was almost like a badge of honor, you know, that you were an enemy of the state and recognized by its most repressive apparatus, its secret police. But we know the function of secret police in other societies. So the list, although it had it never had any functionality. I mean, people did. I mean, they would this Red Squad would find out like someone's parents. And say, do you know your daughter's going out with a colored man? Or do you, you know, call employers? Do you know your accountant is a member of the Socialist Workers Party or the Communist Party or something like that? And get people fired. So that was white radicals. Then they'd have white extremists that they didn't interfere with their life because they saw them as potentials for prosecution. Because they might be involved in some illegal activity. And then the same thing, they had black radicals and black extremists. So, yeah, and the first issue of the Fifth Estate was refused by a printer because it had an anti-war cartoon. And, you know, just on their own, patriotic printers, I remember one time, the first time we went there, this guy met us outside, he said, take this filthy piece of crap out of here and don't ever come back. You know, you're lucky. He said something, but you're lucky I don't set my printers on you, you know. We had coin boxes. You know, you put a quarter in, or you know, I don't think you put a quarter in anymore, but you know, you put a quarter in, you get a paper out of it. Detroit police clipped all of ours off of, you know, light posts and junked them. I mean, one of the things that the society has realized now is that its resilience, because of how powerful it's rooted in its economy and its basic culture, the ones we opposed then and I oppose now, were so formidable that they can let you do anything. You know, you can dye your hair blue, have tattoos across your face, you can transgender, you can be gay, you can be, you know, you name it. And you can put out the Fifth Estate, and what do? You know, it used to be they tried to jail you and kill you. Now they honor us.
Comes back around.
Yeah.
While reporting with the Fifth Estate, what are the most important stories that you think you covered?
Wow. You know, that's tough. I usually, in terms of specific ones, they're around the... I always tend to call it a riot. Don't show Frank this. Around the rebellion was that we were out in the street giving a different point of view. We tried to say why this was happening. Now, you know, wow, why are these colored people doing this? You know, the fact that they had a lot of grievances, and the grievances were so bad that this is how it was expressed. And in a breakthrough of investigative journalism, this Frank Joyce I keep mentioning, who was the news editor, did this investigative reporting that of the type that really wasn't done by any of the dailies. And it was called Who Killed John Leroy? And it was something similar to what we see today. This man, you know, there was actually checkpoints in Detroit with, you know, like in,
East Germany.
Well, more like in Ukraine now or something like that. And something happened, a long story, and these guardsmen, you know, all these white guys from upstate just riddled the car with about, you know, 80 bullets and killed this John Leroy. But, you know, not a lot, as I've gone through lately, all 395 issues we've, for this these exhibits, there's nothing that really stands out. It's like the totality. It is, I guess you can swear on these things, right? Well, this is posters, it's fuck authority. And that may seem a little puerile on the face of it, but what it's essentially saying is that we are still in rebellion, we were then, we are now, still in rebellion against the dominant culture, the dominant economy, and the political apparatus that administers it all for, as a shorthand is called, the 1%. So that's funny. I may have an anthology of what I've written, and there none of them like jump out and say, "Man, this is the greatest thing I've ever written." I mean, I would write an article. And these are later, maybe in the 90s. And when we stopped, now we only come out three. We used to come out once a week. Now we only come out three times a year. And I would write about the origins of the political state. Like, we take it for granted, and we would like some reform. We might like Bernie Sanders better than Donald Trump in there, and things would get better. Yeah. But what the state was, you know, the political state has only been around for about 5% of human existence. So this article, how did it come into being? Why all of a sudden do we have rulers and ruled? You know, why do we have this hierarchy? Why is there... why am I losing my word? Why is there a patriarchy? You know, where did all this come in? Why did men rule when most societies were matriarchal and matrilineal? I mean, what happened here? And how is it related to capitalism? And, you know, a system that we think is, you know, about on the verge of destroying the planet, Paris, a climate accord notwithstanding. Sorry, I don't mean to bring you down.
Well, let's see. Going from the Fifth Estate to radio, how did you make that transition? Why did you make that transition?
Is there any, you know, I keep looking at the water. Is there
Let me put this on a pause real quick.
Okay.
All right. Record pause and record. All right, there we go. We should be good. Yep. And that one. Okay.
We don't see do we see needles? Oh, okay, good, good. Yeah, actually, that was the A word again. Strike that. When early radio began, it was WABX, and that was the station that everybody listened to. It was what they called freeform. There wasn't a playlist, and as soon as the coolest record came out, LP, it would get on WABX. Well, finally, some of the bigger stations started realizing there was a market there. And FM mostly was simulcasting their AM. And the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, said, if you're going to have these public airwaves, you have to have independent programming. So they said, okay, I guess maybe we'll do rock and roll. And then they told them you also had to have public service content. You couldn't just play music, that you had to have something that met the community needs. And that's still true today. And I'm the public affairs director for, you know, the three stations of Greater Media in Detroit. So Harvey Yavshinsky, leading the way for Peter, again, had this show that he called Spare Change, which was a way a lot of hippies made money. They just, got any spare change, man? Even if you're a woman, they'd say, got any spare change, man? You know, and you give it to him or not. Yeah, you know, help your brother, spare change. So he had this hour interview program, and he left to become the news director of WABX, and they said, well, do I want to do it? And I said, well, yeah, I've never done anything like that before. So it essentially became an extension of the Fifth Estate. I got my artist workshop friends and anti-war friends and people talking about social and political issues on the air for an hour, an hour on Sunday. And then I suggested to him that within the Fifth Estate, there were all these departments like youth news, labor news, women's news. And I said, how about if we get somebody from each one of those? And I said, you get a big audience. And so we got different Fifth Estate staff members into each one of those categories. And I was I became a DJ. I actually played rock and roll, but I always had a talk show at some time or other. And in 1972, ABC, which owned WRIF at the time, this all happened on WRIF. I don't know if I said that. It began as WXYZ FM, became WRIF, and they didn't have enough public service programming, so I had a full-time, four-hour-a-night talk show on a rock station, except it went like different times, midnight till 4, you know, 2 a.m. till 6 a.m., and that lasted for about 3.5 years. And then they decided it was overkill, and they could do better by playing rock and roll. So I got into it through the Fifth Estate.
Earlier in the interview, you mentioned that you as a whole, or like the whole movement, wasn't really into rock and roll. How did you guys make the evolution from the more beatniks that only listen to Miles Davis and John Lee Hooker into becoming a rock DJ?
You know, I always liked rock and roll, didn't I? Not as much. I was independently into jazz quite a bit, but I didn't like the Beatles at all. I just thought looked goofy. You know, they had a little teeny short hair, little bangs and all that. And they were a pop band. And they sang, they were white guys singing black songs. And why couldn't, because a lot of their albums, they loved, I found out later, you know, they loved American R&B and rock and roll. And Chuck, they did a lot of Chuck Berry tunes. And so I can't exactly remember, but I remember, this is odd that I remember through somebody else, Sinclair criticized the MC5. And they said, come to one of our concerts, you know, smoke some reefer, like you always do, and come to this. And he was absolutely won over 100%. And there are some pieces on the MC5 album, I think on that Live at the Grandy one, where it's called Black to Calm, C-O-M-M. And that is just free jazz. And this was the influence that he brought to them of the Joseph Jarman and the Chicago Free Art, something or other, you know, that so the fact that I'm stumbling here means that it sort of happened almost organically. It was John Coltrane, and then suddenly it was the Doors and the Who and all the rest of these classic bands that have kind of gotten to be cliches now, you know.
Let's see, what did you find yourself playing a lot as a rock DJ?
Well, that's interesting, because I can't remember, is the most interesting. a lot of those. One of the things I liked to play was long songs. Although I never was high on the air, there was something about these long songs, like The End by The Doors, or even things like Won't Get Fooled Again by The Who, which is about 7 or 8 minutes long. But, you know, I always had a sense, differently, for instance, than people on public radio. They were often, you know, you should hear this because it's very cool. And whereas I always thought more, what do you want to hear? I didn't want to keep playing, like now, WRIF and WCSX, who I work for, are wildly popular, and they play pretty much expected songs. And yet I play songs that are just kind of a little off the center, so I'm not real radical there. And I guess if I was hard pressed to think of a lot of songs I played, I don't know. And maybe unless you were at your age, unless you're a classic rock aficionado, you probably wouldn't know a lot of these songs. But for a while, on WCSX, I and others had this show called Deep Tracks, and we would play songs, not completely free form, but songs that people that were from, I don't know, 40 to 110, when you played them, it wouldn't sound like Muzak the way the main channel sounds now, but you'd go, oh wow, and that's what we always called the wow factor. I wanted to get things on there that the audience would go, wow, that's so cool that I'm not going to play. I'm trying to think of an example. Steve Miller Band, Take the Money and Run. Oh, which plays like on a classic station. They play it like 250 times a year, whereas I would play it zero. And play some Steve Miller tune that, I don't know, something like Motherless Children or something like that that you might not be aware of, but, that somebody who was in that era would go, oh, wow. So, and in the same way, I didn't want to write a newspaper I wanted to give people information that I would think they would be appreciative of getting that they might not get from another source.
But you seem to have always kind of, talk radio has always been your focus, talking to people.
Yeah. I mean, I would go back into I even suggested a Deep Tracks format to sell nationally. I mean, long story, but it didn't work. So I love the music. I'm not that deeply knowledgeable of it all. I know what people like. I know, and I mean, I am like maybe a step and a half above the audience, whereas somebody like Doug Podell is like 10 steps of. And who could put together a good show? I'm not trying to say that. But I've never read a rock biography ever. I mean, it seems so boring. I never listened to interviews with rockers. I couldn't care less well, why'd you write that song, man? Who cares? Let me get the question back in my brain. I'm sorry. What?
Talk radio.
Oh, talk radio. Yeah, but talk radio has always been foremost because it's political ideas that motivated me. Things I learned actually at Michigan State, when I was like 20 years old and had this inchoate radicalism, but had no ideas whatsoever other than, I hated, in high school, I hated teachers, I hated cops, I hated, patriotism and all that, and I couldn't even tell why. And then all of a sudden I go, whoa, So I when people tell me, your program has been so influential on me, it's not like a power thing, is that I know that people have been able to move out of the mainstream where they anchor their ideas and go to another place of ethical validation, if you will. I mean, maybe that's dressing it up too much, but to some extent, that's what it is.
You've interviewed lots of people over the years. What do you think your most important interviews were?
Again, that's just like the Fifth Estate. It is the totality of it. And some of the best interviews have been like an associate professor of sociology at Loyola or something like that. Because, again, it's more of the idea that people say, you interviewed Frank Zappa or you interviewed this person or that person. The only one of famous people, and again, it's his fame, it may not have even reached you, is Pete Seeger?
Yeah.
Okay. That was such a joy. I mean, that almost, as soon as I think about it, starts tugging at my teardrops. He said, and maybe that's what's happening to me too, he says, how long is this for? I said, it's 25 minutes. He said, Pete, because he called me Pete too. He says, I don't think I can do it. He said, I'm an old man, my voice is giving out. At 30 minutes, he's singing in this broken voice. You know, he said, my voice is terrible, but I wanted to sing that for you and all that. So in many ways, I've never really gone after real famous people because that is, people want to hear it because the person's famous. I want to get a guy on the air that that's written a book called Angry White Men, for instance. Why are these guys, you know, what's their deal? I mean, why are they... going into Planned Parenthood clinics and shooting people up, and that's not even what it is. Why are they brutal towards women and children? And why are they in fights? Why do they think they have to, ride motorcycles to which I have, to assert their masculinity and all of that? So it's always been about the ideas, and I always feel like I'm letting people down when I don't say, oh, I interviewed, President, somebody or other, or something like that. So no, it's about the ideas always.
So you've been doing it about 45 years, you said?
Yeah, it started in 1970, right?
Have you found yourself changing in the radio business over the last 45 years, or do you think you're the same kind of interviewer you were 45 years ago?
Oh, interviewer?
Well, you were going to say something, so go with that.
No, I don't know. I mean, what I was going to say was, it's hard to tell. You know that, you getting to be 75 years is a long time. You know, once in a while, I see a photograph of myself and think, no, there's not. Is there one of me in there? No, good. you change without realizing it, and you realize, I played something from like 5 years ago, and I was thinking, God, my voice is getting into that kind of godfather old man voice, but I don't think that's what you mean. Yeah, I'm sure my skills have picked up, but one of the things that I do, and it probably isn't the best. I'm sure you probably listen to interviews. They're very fast. The guy or woman always breaks in after the person is about two or three sentences. And I know, I usually let people go on quite a bit, which is not a modern mode. But again, I'm not interested in showing the audience. I'm there and I've got really cool questions. And I want this person to finish their thought. I want to find out what this example is of, I'm trying to think, who do I have? Well, I don't even know what this is about. Something about... To die in the Anthropocene. I'm interviewing somebody on that tomorrow. I don't even know what the book's about. I mean, that's one thing you could. I could do that. I mean, I will look at the book and read through it a bit tonight. But I could go in there and do it. And say, what's your book about? And because I have a base of general knowledge that I can ask questions that, it would bring the show along. And also, what I do is I try to ask questions that I think that the audience would like to hear answered, not even to let this guy totally express himself. Because I will say, look, I said, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with you. But I think a reply to that if you didn't use military force, something like ISIS is just going to grow. So why not just take 200,000 U.S. troops, land there, wipe them out? And that end of problem, solution dealt with. And then they would say why they wouldn't think that would be a good idea. But so I often try to put myself in the place of the listener.
So this interview is going to go to the Reuther, which is one of the main Detroit archives. So let me bring this back to Detroit for a minute. The Fifth Estate for a while was not published in Detroit. About 10, 15 years ago, something like that. It was moved down south.
To Tennessee, yeah.
And then you're currently doing your radio show out of Ferndale, correct?
Well, the WRFWCSX offices and studios are in, actually they're in Royal Oak Township. But they're on North End, just west of Wyoming.
So was there something important that held you, as well as the Fifth Estate and the counterculture and all of that, in Detroit, And is there a reason that it has since left? And then transition that into, yeah. You made a joke about the Midtown movement.
Right.
How do you
rebranding.
Feel about? Yes.
Yeah. Well, in 2000, we were going along in the 90s. I think we even used to come out we had about 6 issues a year, maybe even 12. I can't remember. I mean, there's different iterations of it. But I got a full-time nationally syndicated talk show. Myself and my current on-air partner, Jolene Jordan, if you care, J-U-L-I-N-E, Jordan. And I plus I kept my riff show. So I was doing talk radio 6 days a week, and I was totally miserable. For once in my life, I was making an extraordinary amount of money, which I'd never made before, because I usually only worked part-time. You know, we didn't have any kids, my wife and I, and we're not, capitalism would collapse if consumers operated at our level. And so, we were always doing just fine. And so at one point, I don't think the Pith Estate maybe didn't come out for 10 months or something like that. And so this colleague, friend who had moved to this farm, what do you call these damn things?
Commune.
Thank you. I should know. The communal farm called Pumpkin Hollow, which I'd visited a number of times. That he said, well, look, I and some friends down there, and he was from Detroit, and he'd worked on the Fifth Estate here in the 90s, and he said, I'll put it out down at Pumpkin Hollow. So he did a marvelous job from 2003 to, was it just then? 2007, 2008, and for a lot of reasons, he couldn't do it anymore, and so it shifted back here. But the whole time, we were all involved, and I went down there a couple of times while they were doing the design, the layout, as it used to be called. And we said, born and raised hell in the Motor City, and just for a while, it kind of took a little rural Tennessee diversion.
So how do you feel about the Midtown kind of rebranding and the loss of kind of the cast corridor?
I don't mean to sound like some whining old guy that's not, not down with the new program. But what's happened, of course, is with, a lot of ways, it appeals to my white middle class sensibility. It's, nice, clean, safe, everything like that. Whereas, a lot of times walking down Cass Avenue, you had to watch yourself. It was an area with poor people. Poor people, as always, have pretty much been driven out. And last Saturday, I was walking on Canfield. I just couldn't believe it. I mean, there was traffic jams, $5 parking, suburbanites galore. And I'll tell you, a couple of years ago, even just like 2 years ago, by most people, and I still get this a little when I talk to guests from out of town, this was conceived as a disaster. Detroit was conceived as a disaster zone. And a black city with a black mayor, corruption and poverty galore. And now it is almost flipped in terms of virtually conceived of as a white city, even though that 85% of the residents are still African Americans. There's a white mayor, everybody from artists to cooks from all over the country are coming here. Well, I'm of that class, that social class, so I relate to these people. And when artists come that work on the Fifth Estate, a guy moves here from Hawaii, if you can imagine that, and works on the Fifth Estate, that's pretty cool. And there's all this energy. And you go into Hamtramck, and there's galleries in every block almost, and, music galore, and, Jack White opening up stuff, and Shinola, and they still don't know shit from Shinola, I'll tell you. But whatever. That row looks like something not really off of Fifth Avenue in New York, but almost gave me that same vibe. And that's what happens. The bankruptcy helped the city get back on its feet. It screwed the pensioners. That now poor people some are even moving out of the city. There's this whole movement towards the closer in suburbs of very poor people, where it's actually cheaper to live. Although there's a lot of areas still that the only people that live in those areas are people that have no way to get out. So, I mean, that, I don't know what to say. I mean, do I like it better when it was down and dirty and funky? To some extent. I was, a friend of mine, Ben Hall, who runs the Russell Street Deli, and he's an artist, and he had a exhibit at, like, the guy always has the address, 9278, I think it's called, it's him, on Campo, right by Holbrook. And we walked down south to the Yemen Cafe. You ever been there? Oh, amazing. And I was saying, man, this feels like the Chaos Corridor 30 years ago. But, you know, it's hard to say. It's better for a lot of people. It's the same or worse for others. I mean, but it is bringing in people that have no consciousness about the process whatsoever. They just think it's, quote, nice. I got an idea, dear. Let's go down to Midtown, you know.
Right. On the way to the Fisher,
yeah,
where you can kind of stay isolated. Well, we're getting toward the end. Considering the career path you've had and all of the things you've done against authority and, you know, trying to evolve culture, how successful do you think you, and by you I mean the Fifth State, your generation, you yourself, how successful do you think you were in moving culture along and trying to work against the political?
Well, there's actually several questions in there. I mean, obviously, we've changed the culture incredibly. I mean, as I was saying earlier, 60 years ago, if you didn't have a crew cut or weren't wearing, you know, a skirt and nylons and high heels, you were thought to be, you know, terrible. Now, I mean, you look on television and there's guys with, you know, 3 and 4 day old beards and shirts out. I mean, you know, be a young man, tuck your shirt in, or young man, take your hat off. Who takes their hat off anymore? So anything goes. The librarian down there has purple hair, right? I don't know. Was I saying that on the tape about the resiliency of the system? No, maybe we were off when we were talking about, huh?
We might have been off.
Okay. I mean, the system is so resilient that it can take any superficial, and I don't say that disparagingly, any superficial resistance whatsoever. As long as you don't mess with the economic and imperial mechanism of the society, you can do it. Like I said, if you're a guy, you can marry a guy, you can wear purple hair, you can wear your hair to your ass, you can wear tattoos around your neck, you know, it doesn't matter. They thought that if you said shit, you know, in public, that the whole system would crumble. You know, and that's what totalitarian regimes are. You know, you say one word against it, you're in jail. I don't know. I mean, we've brought it along, sure. I mean, we've formed the terms of people that are still resistant to the dominant culture and the dominant economy. And you know, think about just recently in 2011, Occupy. Say, oh, well, that went away pretty quickly. Well, the whole idea about disparity of wealth is in common discussion. The 1%. I say on the air, I mean, it used to be a very, I don't know if it's a Marxist phrase or not, with the ruling class. I mean, I talk about it all the time, the ruling class, and that there is a class of rulers that have their own class interests that are inimical to the rest of us. Sometimes, if you're white and middle class, well-positioned, now it's not even guaranteed, you do okay. I mean, if you're below that, you're kind of screwed, and most of the rest of the world gets kind of screwed by it all. So I would say, as a person, both in terms of what I wanted to accomplish, I'm very, it sounds arrogant, I'm very pleased with myself. I'm very pleased with my life, what I've accomplished. Would I have wanted to accomplish more? Would I want to have a newspaper with this message that had 100,000 a week? Sure. So in that regard, if you even measure it up against like The Nation magazine, do you know that? The Nation magazine? I don't know what I think they have about 35, 40,000 a week. Yeah, you know, this is a failure. Is there, you know, could we don't have a mechanism that can pay people, that could, you know, sustain them within radical journalism. But I would say overall, Yeah, I'm happy with what we did. I think we ended a war. I think we were, among white people, a real force against white racism in terms of gender equality. We've done what we could for that, against the patriarchy, and on the whole list of the awful things that this society. And the other thing, someone said, Janet Jones at Sourcebooks over there on CAS, she said, we've all done the best we could, and I think we have.
I think that's a good place to end.
I have a sense of show business.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.